From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a record budget request for the International Committee of the Red Cross reflects an explosion of global conflicts and violence. No election is seen in Thailand until at least 2016. And on this Thanksgiving Day, holiday shoppers prepare to begin their search.
It breaks my heart, it really does, to see that this is all, you know, about the money. It's not about the Thanksgiving.
It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The International Committee of the Red Cross is appealing for a record $1.68 billion to help millions of people whose lives are torn apart by armed conflict and violence. The Swiss humanitarian agency says an explosion of conflict and violence, particularly in the Middle East and Africa, is threatening regional stability and putting development prospects of impoverished countries at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the nature of armed conflict is changing. ICRC President Peter Morris says new kinds of crises are emerging in new combinations, often with a regional dimension.
We are not anymore in a situation where we have a clear-cut international or internal armed conflicts with clear-cut front lines and positions unfolding in front of us. We see international armed conflict, internal armed conflict, criminal violence, intercommunal violence, superpositioning itself in the same contexts.
Morris says the conflict in Syria has long ceased to be a civil war. It has become a regional crisis engulfing Iraq, Lebanon, and Jordan. He says extremism is deepening some of the conflicts being waged, leading to increasingly violent behavior.
200,000 people have been killed since the beginning of the conflict in Syria. 9,200 civilians have been killed since the beginning of this year in Iraq. Syria and Iraq have become the epicenters of regional and global insecurities.
Syria is the largest ICRC operation, followed by South Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Israel and the occupied territories, Mali, the Central African Republic, and Ukraine. ICRC President Morris says conflict and violence not only kills people, it kills development. He says it is sad to see how even modest progress, which has been made in some impoverished, conflict-ridden countries, has been destroyed. He says health systems, water and sanitation systems, and habitats are being disrupted by violence.
It's not limited, but exemplified with the conflict in the Middle East. But we see the same phenomenon in the Sahel. We see the same phenomenon in the Horn of Africa, with massive displacements and neighboring countries not coping with the number of displaced and therefore health, water, sanitation, housing systems disintegrating, states basically not capable anymore to deliver basic services to people.
Given the increasing dangers, the Red Cross says it plans to focus greater attention on the protection needs of people caught in conflict. But it says it will continue to give priority to health, particularly surgical care for the wounded. The Red Cross says it also will strengthen its response to sexual violence in places such as the Central African Republic, Central America, Colombia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Lebanon, Mali, and South Sudan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Midwestern U.S. town of Ferguson, Missouri, passed a calmer night Wednesday into Thursday morning as residents prepared to celebrate the Thanksgiving holiday despite recent racial strife. Ferguson saw only scattered protests late Wednesday after two previous nights of unrest and rioting that left dozens of buildings damaged or burned. The unrest followed Monday's announcement that a white police officer will not be prosecuted over the shooting death of an unarmed black teenager. A heavy police presence, snowy weather, and today's Thanksgiving holiday may have helped to shrink the crowds by Wednesday night. Earlier, hundreds of people demonstrated in front of the St. Louis City Hall on Wednesday, chanting, "Shame, shame." Police arrested three people for failing to disperse, including one who also faces an assault charge. The August shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson inflamed tensions in Ferguson and raised concerns about police violence and racial discrimination in the mostly black St. Louis suburb. Well, for U.S. President Barack Obama, the issue of race relations is deeply personal. Throughout the crisis in Ferguson, the president has urged calm, restraint, and respect for the rule of law. As VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports, the events in Ferguson have prompted Mr. Obama to call more openly than he has before for profound changes to end the racism and distrust that he believes still exists between whites and blacks in the United States.
The violence in Ferguson caused President Obama to use language more forceful than he has in the past about race, breaking taboos about the issue for Americans, many of whom hoped that having a black president in the White House would mean scenes like these would be a thing of the past. Violence erupted in Ferguson the night the nation learned that white police officer Darren Wilson would not be indicted for fatally shooting Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager. In appealing for calm, President Obama said the situation in Ferguson speaks to broader challenges still facing the nation.
We need to recognize that this is not just an issue for Ferguson. This is an issue for America. We have made enormous progress in race relations over the course of the past several decades. I have witnessed that in my own life, and to deny that progress, I think, is to deny America's capacity for change. But what is also true is that there are still problems, and communities of color aren't just making these problems up.
Analysts say it is not the pain and anger alone of the demonstrators that prompted Mr. Obama to speak more openly about race relations. With only 2 years left in his term, they say Mr. Obama has less to lose by taking the conversation on race relations a step further. Daniela Gibbs Legere is a former senior aide to the president.
The political risk, obviously, he's not running for re-election anymore, so that's sort of mitigated. Is there other types of risk? Always, whenever you're talking about race in this country. But I also think that it goes beyond the political risk, and it's something that's very personal to him.
Mr. Obama has spoken passionately on race issues before. In 2012, when black teenager Trayvon Martin was shot and killed in Florida in another racially charged case, the president said Martin could have been his son. This time, the president warned inaction could lead to more tension and violence.
And those who are only interested in focusing on the violence and just want the problem to go away need to recognize that we do have work to do here. And we shouldn't try to paper it over.
Michael Fauntroy is a politics professor at Howard University in Washington. He says that while Mr. Obama's remarks on race are more forceful than before, he questions whether the president was forceful enough.
What happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and the aftermath is something that the president was sort of forced to comment on. So, yes, that is true. He is breaking a taboo. But I hope that now that the taboo is broken, that he will actually do something with it.
When President Obama took office, there were hopes among many Americans, both black and white, that America's race problems would largely go away. Events in Ferguson show that resolving hundreds of years of racial strife will take more than one man and one presidency. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Authorities in Thailand, which is under martial law and being run by a retired general, say they do not foresee holding elections next year as originally promised. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
A senior official told reporters Thursday that it is impossible to hold a national election next year because of groups in Thailand who oppose the ruling junta, named the National Council for Peace and Order. Pravit Wongsuwan, a retired commander-in-chief of the Royal Thai Army, who holds the posts of defense minister and deputy prime minister in the junta's cabinet, also said authorities need more time to write a new constitution. Pravit says Thailand will be able to organize elections around the start of 2016, once the constitution is drafted. Previously, coup instigator and now Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha had promised a return to democracy with elections around October of 2015. Sunay Phasuk, the senior researcher on Thailand for the international non-governmental organization Human Rights Watch, says the slipping timeline for polling is not unexpected.
It's not a surprise at all. It's clear that the junta has no commitment to fulfill the promise to restore democratic civilian rule within a year.
The previous constitution was scrapped by then-Army Chief Prayut, and a committee appointed to draft a new one after the general toppled Thailand's civilian government 6 months ago in a bloodless coup. It was the latest in a long series of political interventions by the military over the decades to oust elected or appointed governments. Human Rights Watch earlier this week lamented that Thailand had fallen into an apparently bottomless pit because criticism is systematically prosecuted, political activity is banned, media is censored, and dissidents are tried in military courts. In that current atmosphere, Sunay says, it is not possible to conduct a credible election.
Political activity, including activity of political parties, have been banned. There is no assurance that when election happens, it is going to be a free and fair election where everyone can contest freely, can express their campaign freely.
Junta officials have acknowledged that a primary objective of the May 22nd coup is to permanently eradicate the political influence of the Shinawat clan. Political parties allied with the wealthy family have won every national election since 2001, in large part by appealing to the disaffected poor in the rural north. Thaksin Shinawat was ousted as prime minister in a coup in 2006 and is now considered a fugitive in exile. His sister, Yingluck Shinawat, was forced out of the same post shortly before this year's coup. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The 12-nation oil cartel, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, meeting in Vienna today, has decided to keep daily output steady at about 30 million barrels. It took this action despite a 30% drop in prices since June amid an economic slowdown in China, India, and Europe, and the onslaught of North American shale oil. Vandana Hari, Asia editorial director at the global energy information firm Platts, speaking from Singapore, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the cartel has in the past tried to provide balance to global oil prices. This time, she says, it declined to cut production and says that is not surprising.
They are, you know, sometimes often suspicious of each other's motives and whether each member adheres to the new limits, the lower limits that are handed out. While we tend to see this as a homogeneous organization with a common principle to keep oil markets balanced, it's important to remember that the production cost, the target oil price that each of the member needs varies greatly. There are members with deeper pockets, with relatively lower production costs like Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, there are members like Venezuela, Iran, which have been the traditional price hawks, which need a much higher price. So getting unanimity on a production cut has always been difficult. It's particularly problematic right now because the cartel did away with individual member country quotas starting 2011. So in order for any effective cut to be made now, they would actually need to go back to the drawing board and start handing out member countries' quotas, which at this point of time would be nothing short of a miracle, especially to achieve it in a matter of a day.
Vandana, what is the future of OPEC 40 years on?
People are actually questioning even OPEC's relevance right now because it does seem like it is giving up that role of balancing supply and demand. Equally, I think it's important to bear in mind that it's in a very different dynamics right now. If you look back to 2008, when the organization managed remarkable cut of 4.2 million barrels per day in the space of a few months and three meetings, while the supply was still more or less in OPEC's hands to balance, right now it's not. And what, to me, it seems to be saying now is that it doesn't want to take on unilaterally the role of balancing when a lot of the oversupply is actually coming out from the tight oil production in the U.S.
Obviously, oil is a cyclical commodity. It goes up and it goes down. How long would the current down price last, do you think?
What is expected to happen with the low prices is, of course, the marginal cost barrels, whether it's conventional oil or whether it's tight oil in the U.S., should start dropping off. The higher cost barrels should start closing down, or rather not coming into the market. At the same time, it will be a little bit difficult given the current economic problems globally, but lower oil prices should also start bringing some of the demand that might have been curbed by over $100 prices, some of that demand back into the market. So these two opposing forces should gradually start lifting oil prices back to what might be a more equilibrium level for the near future.
That's Vandana Hari. She's the Asia Editorial Director at the global energy information firm Platts. She says lower prices reduce the incentive for oil companies to invest in exploration. Should there be a resurgence in demand, those two factors could drive the price of crude up to above $100 a barrel. However, Hari doesn't see that happening for the next 12 to 18 months. As for Asia, primarily an oil-consuming region rather than a producer, Hari says lower prices provide an environment conducive to economic growth. She says in recent months, lower oil prices have allowed countries like India, Indonesia, and Malaysia to cut costly fuel subsidies, saving them a combined $20 billion annually.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Australian cricketer Phil Hughes, who was struck in the head with a ball during a match this week in Sydney, has died. Team doctor Peter Bruckner said in a statement, the 25-year-old died today, surrounded by his family and friends. Hughes had been put in a medically induced coma and underwent emergency surgery following the Tuesday accident. Bruckner said Hughes never regained consciousness and was not in pain before he passed. Hughes was hit just behind the left ear by a bounced ball while batting for South Australia against New South Wales at the Sydney Cricket Ground. Condolences poured in following the news of his death, including from Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Hughes is the second cricket player in his many years to die after being struck by a ball. 32-year-old South African player Darren Randall died last year after being struck in the side of the head. Well, Americans are marking the annual Thanksgiving holiday today with family gatherings, meals, and bargain shopping. Feasts centering on turkeys with an array of traditional sides and desserts are a tradition for the holiday that falls on the fourth Thursday in November. On the eve of the holiday, President Obama and his family handed out food to clients of a center in Washington that provides food, clothing, and other services to the poor. Earlier in the day, Mr. Obama followed a specifically presidential tradition of pardoning a turkey. The White House ran an online contest in the past week, asking people to vote on which bird should get the pardon, cheese or fellow turkey, Mac. While cheese won the official pardon, both turkeys, each weighing about 23 kilograms, will be spared the chopping block. But Thanksgiving is also an opportunity for Americans to reflect on the gifts and blessings in their lives and to express gratitude for them. VOA's Adam Phillips took to the streets to ask some of his fellow New Yorkers what they're grateful for and what they think gratitude is.
At a cafe on Manhattan's Upper West Side, just days before Thanksgiving, a young woman named Sue says she's grateful for New York.
I was in Boston for the last 8 years, and I just moved back this September, and I am loving it, being with my family and meeting new friends, so I'm having a great time in New York. Today, it's 70 degrees, middle of November, and have great coffee. That's great.
Meanwhile, Christopher, a newspaper editor, muses about what gratitude is.
It means to be thankful and to realize that the good that you have in the world doesn't come from you, but it is given to you. Every breath I take is a a miracle. I didn't provide it. God gives that to me. And so the fact that I'm alive, I'm grateful for. And if you begin there, you realize that you really have to be grateful for everything that you have. I'm grateful that I live in a country that is not at war here, that there are not bombs going off where I live, that I live in a place that is warm in this cold season, that I have enough to eat. Those are good starts.
Jonah, a Columbia University graduate student, also feels thankful.
Feeling it and expressing it lead to, at least for me, very different reactions on my part. I think it actually, in some sense, takes courage to express real gratitude to somebody. I mean, we say thank you to people all the time, that we're grateful for this and for that, but it almost requires opening yourself up and being a little vulnerable to really express a full, deep gratitude about something.
A young mother named Alexandra feels gratitude for her family and friends.
I guess it's a combination of happiness and peace, being content with what you have, being aware maybe, noticing, thinking about it. You can just be grateful, I think, to no one in particular, to good fortune. I don't know if that counts as someone, but I mean, I certainly don't believe in a God or anything like that. I'm not thanking a God. I'm just thankful for, you know, for a good life, thankful for the random luck of a good life.
Ben has a more political take on the season. He says he's grateful to anyone that enhances one's possibility for a better life, and that's why he's grateful for President Barack Obama.
It's a wonder to have a person who has a sense of possibility when it comes to politics, and yet is not defined by his determination to manipulate people. It's a very strange capacity to, on the one hand, have capacity to imagine the world larger than just sort of using people, and yet at the same time understand what you need to do to get things done. I have an African-American son, so that might have some partly to do with him. It's just grace. It makes my kid feel like he's, you know, part of America.
Whether it's because a world figure looks like you or because the apple pie is still warm, gratitude for our many gifts is what makes Thanksgiving a day of the spirit as well as the stomach for Americans worldwide. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Well, another Thanksgiving tradition is shopping sales in crowded stores. Retailers who used to remain closed are opening their stores earlier, with many kicking off their holiday sales on Thanksgiving Day. But as Mil Arcega reports, many are not happy about it.
Stuffing and green beans?
Stuffing and green beans had to be the sides.
Never mind the traditional meal of roast turkey with family and friends. For some, Thanksgiving Day will mark the unofficial start to the holiday shopping season. Although some have called it the decline of an American tradition, consumers looking for the best bargains say they can't wait.
I understand both sides of it, but I always want to take advantage of a deal, so I'm going to come out and shop.
It's less amusing for those who have to work during the holiday. Kmart employee Donna Fisher was told she has to work or face the consequences. And she says that's unfair.
There's no choice in it whatsoever. It breaks my heart, it really does, to see that this is all, you know, about the money. It's not about the Thanksgiving.
So her daughter Jillian launched an online petition demanding Kmart allow its employees time off on Thanksgiving Day so they can be with their families. Thousands have signed the petition, and the majority of people we spoke with seem to agree.
It's a national holiday, we should all be enjoying it.
Some say it's an opportunity for those who may need the extra cash. But nearly everyone we spoke with say it should be up to the workers to decide.
Well, yeah, they probably could use the extra money, but I think it should be a matter of choice if you want to come in. It should not be a demand for you to come in.
Christmas and Thanksgiving are the busiest travel days for Americans. While retailers insist the early start will make it more convenient for shoppers, others argue the large crowds and the hype are not worth the savings. Unofficially, the Consumer Federation of America's Stephen Brobeck believes the holiday marketing onslaught should begin after Thanksgiving.
I don't know whether most Americans are concerned, but I am personally, in part because I don't feel as if I have an adequate opportunity to count my blessings at Thanksgiving.
Those buying gifts for friends and family are expected to spend more than $600 billion during the holiday season, or about 4% more than they did last year. Kmart is just one of a long list of stores trying to get a bigger share of consumer dollars. Macy's department store plans to open Thanksgiving Day, as will retail giant Walmart. Miller.